This and every episode of the Ginger Veteran Podcast is supported by our friends at Field Issued, a veteran-led effort building tools, mentorship, and creative opportunities for veterans and their families. If you're looking for something real to plug into, something built by vets, for vets, stay tuned. Field Issued is growing fast, and big things are coming. Hi guys, welcome to the Ginger Veteran Podcast. I'm your host, Fred Gregory. Today we got an interview with Clayton. Wanted to get him on the show. We've been talking back and forth for a little bit, trying to get this thing going on. Had my back surgery, had bronchitis, had some family stuff come up. I got behind, as you guys know. So now that I finally got Clayton here, I want to give him the time to give himself a little bit of an introduction and kind of explain to us why he wanted to get on the show and tell his story. So Clayton, I'll give you the floor and let you talk.
Sounds good, man. So thank you for having me, first off. It's a long journey, and being able to share that with everybody is super important. That voice can help keep at least one person from doing the dumb things that I did. And that's really all that matters. So a little bit about me. I am a 10-year Air Force veteran. Started off with AFSOC, moved over to ground transportation. Midway through my career, to try and get less deployments. It did not happen that way. I actually deployed more than I did in AFSOC. And that was silly me. Shouldn't have trusted the words of a recruiter. But I guess we all did that. So.
Yeah, at some point,
the National Guard guys showed up. They were like, "You get double pay and double this, double that. You don't deploy as much." And I was like, "This sounds great."
Yeah, yeah. At some point, at some point, we all sat down and listened to a recruiter talk, and we were like, "Man, you've sold me on this. This is great. Like, nothing is ever going to be shitty about this, right?"
Yeah, like zero negatives in mind.
Yeah. Like my,
it went super poor.
Yeah, like my recruiter actually told me, you'll never do PT outside of your 6:30 to 7:30 time frame. I was like, oh man, that's cool. The first PT test I took for BLC for my leadership course was at 1300. So right after lunch, it was the middle of July, and we were cooking. Like it was crazy. So recruiters, I mean, they got to sell you sunshine and rainbows, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. The whole Crayola box, the whole every color, except for the black one. they don't want you to hear about the ones that you don't ever use, like they try not to sell you the white ones or the black ones. They just tell you, oh, look at the blues, man. Look at the blues. Look at all the blues. Look at these blues. You want a Camaro? Here you go. We got you, buddy.
Yep.
Honestly, my military career started off amazing. My time in active duty was fantastic. I mean, I joined at 18 after dropping out of college. So I was in college like 2 months. Realized that the money really wasn't there. I joined basically immediately at I dropped out in September. I left in December. So it was a pretty short turnaround. Got into basic. Basic went like basic does. And then went to indoc, selection, all that stuff. All that went great. Got to my first duty station at Nellis. And like life was good. I mean, being in Las Vegas as a young troop is horrible because you can't do anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just temptation all around you. Right. So you're depressed. You're mad because all your friends are 22, 23. They're going out. You're stuck at home. Sad. but after my first deployment, I came home and I'm like, man, maybe this Call of Duty in real life thing wasn't as cool as I thought it was going to be. I think I might have miscalculated this just a little bit. I love doing what I do, but man, does it hurt.
Yeah.
And so I started questioning how long my career was going to be. I mean, at that point, I'm halfway through my contract, got 3 more years, and started kind of trying to figure out what I was going to do with life. And about a year later, I had my daughter, and she was born as I was getting off a plane from Afghanistan. And I was like, okay, this close. This close to missing the most important day of my entire life.
Yeah.
Due to a fight that I don't even understand, to be completely honest. So, because, I mean, the surge was over. You know, OEF was over. Because I'm a inherent resolve veteran. So, like, still GWAP, but I'm the end, you know. Like, I'm all the counterinsurgency stuff and, you know, hunting down specific people. And, you know, the days of actual war fighting were over, you know. So we're just basically getting ambushed and sitting there. And so, you know, by that point, we were kind of questioning what we were doing and why we were there in the first place and all that kind of stuff. And so I got home, and that's when I met the Air National Guard recruiter, and he sold me a very pretty story. And he was like, "You want to go home?"
Yeah.
I would love to go home. The desert is so hot. I'm so sick of being in the desert. Because I'm from Colorado originally, so you know, I had never in my life been this hot. And then I got to Kuwait and Iraq, and I was like, I will never complain about being hot again. This was a whole new level of hot. What the hell is this?
Yeah.
Like, especially Kuwait City. Kuwait City in July, man, was hell on earth. I don't know why Iraq wanted that place, but it's hot.
Yeah.
It's real hot. And they're right on the ocean, so it's humid too.
Yeah.
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah, I'm from Tennessee, and my first duty station was Fort Bliss out in El Paso, Texas. Solid desert, man. Gross. Yeah, just absolutely disgusting.
And that's a Mexico desert too.
Yeah,
like that's a stone's throw from Juarez, man. That's hot.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's it's hot in more ways than one, man. It could get bad. It could get rough.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's the wool socks situation, man, and I hate being hot. It's funny because I still live in the desert now, but mostly because I'm used to it and I can't really go anywhere else because it makes my bones hurt.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, it hits like -10, and I hibernate. I hide inside my house. I keep it 70 degrees at a maximum, 65, depends on how chilly I'm feeling.
Yeah, same, man.
Most of the time, it stays nice and cozy.
Yeah, I keep mine 65 year round, winter, summer, doesn't matter. Two fans to sleep plus the ceiling fan. Gotta have that noise plus the air circulation.
Exactly. See, and people don't understand that it's little things that you pick up over the course of your career, usually because you're very uncomfortable, that you can't stop doing because they became such a habit to you, right? Like, here in Vegas, my first few apartments, I always kept it, like, subarctic in my house. And the only reason it's at, like, 68 is because my wife refuses to allow me to put it in cold. So, I tried to explain to her, I'm like, look, it's not like I'm heating an 8-bedroom house here. Like, you know, I'm more than willing to pay what we got.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm gonna keep it icebox chilly. Like, if I don't have to put a hoodie on when I come inside after it's 120 degrees outside, I don't think I want to be here. she hates it. She's from Southern California, so she's like, listen, the weather's not that bad.
Yeah.
Like, get used to it, so stop talking.
Yeah.
it's so bad. I hate it. I hate it. She's like, you hate being uncomfortable, don't you? And I was like, really? Really? Anytime I've ever been uncomfortable, people are trying to kill me. Why would I want to be uncomfortable?
Right.
Like, if that association is there, why would I want to be there? That just doesn't make sense. So, you know, spinning back convinced me to go home. I wanted to go to California. I wanted to be by the beach. Thankfully, they convinced me to go home because turns out you don't get double paid. You don't even get half paid, and you're actually making like a tenth of what your active duty money is. You got to figure things out. Guard is awesome. So I stayed deployed because the money wasn't great unless you were deployed. So I did everything under the sun. They sent me out for drug interdiction. They sent me out for, fighting wildfires. Went out to handle a hurricane in Puerto Rico. Did support for hurricanes in Florida. I did. I was a prison guard for a little bit through the guard, which was weird. Very, very strange time. Then I got tasked with the COVID response mission. That one got weirder. Because that was the first time I ever had to be a medic.
Yeah.
I was not a medic. So,
man, COVID in the military was just absolutely strange. I mean,
hot garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm sitting there on Monday with my truck master, another NCO, and I'm sitting over there in the same office, right? And then we have our masks that we have to wear when we go into like medical facilities and stuff. But we're sitting like, I mean, not even 20 feet apart, right? And you know, my truck master's like, well, if I have to wear a mask all the time, I'm just not doing it. Well, of course, we all said that, right? You know, we all said, well, if I have to do this, I'm not doing it, right? I don't want to do it. And then the directive came down. Hey, you guys, you have to wear a mask everywhere, like all over the place, right?
Yeah.
So then our company commander was like, well, I have a bright idea. Let's split everything up into three shifts. That way, you know, we can keep minimal amount of people and people won't have to wear a mask as much because we work mostly outside. Oh, that's a great idea. So Monday, I'm in the office, no mask. Tuesday, wearing a mask. Wednesday, I'm off because Wednesday night, I'm coming in working third shift. Well, Thursday morning.
Not so great of an idea now.
Yeah. Thursday morning, they were like, yeah, this isn't going to work. Like, we're going to go back to just having everybody come in. Weirdest thing ever, man. Like, I don't understand how the military survived COVID, honestly, because the way that people were going about it was just absolutely crazy.
Well, and like, we shut everything down. We shut down full operations on the base for like 3 months, which sucked because I was in California when the world locked down.
Yeah.
Which is not where my base was. I was on vacation out there, and I got stuck out there because like I called as soon as I got the word that like Colorado shut down, Nevada shut down, California shut down, and so I called my commander. My commander was like, "Do not move." He was like, "Stay. I don't care where you are. Just stay there. Don't move." I'm like, "Well, what am I supposed to do, man? Like, I can't afford to live here. I can't do anything. Like, what do you mean? Just stay where I am? Doesn't make any sense."
Yeah.
I was like, just stay where you are. We'll contact you. And then 3 months later, they were threatening me for being AWOL, for being in California. I was like, you told me to stay here. I was like, I don't know what you want me to do. Make up your mind. And then they recalled me back to Colorado. So I get there, and they're like, hey, man, you're going on a COVID response mission. And I'm like, okay, cool. What's that mean? They're like, we don't know yet. You'll meet with the state health department, and they'll tell you more. So I got to state health department. They were like, hey, I don't know if you got a place or not, but you need to break your lease. Like, why? They're like, because you got to stay here in this hotel. I'm like, okay. Sweet life of Zach and Cody up in here. That's cool. That's fine, I guess. Is it a nice hotel? They're like, it's a Hilton. I'm like, all right, well, this is not a crappy hotel. And next thing you know, we're all living in this hotel for 6 months.
Yeah.
Going out doing missions all over the city, all over the state. We were what we call Team 7. So Team 7 was the mobile support. So our job was to go into high-risk facilities, conduct vaccinations, take over for their staff if, like, their staff needed it, stuff like that. So we went into the UK variant. I don't know if you remember when that was, like, huge news that the UK variant had, like, popped up in some small town in Colorado.
Yeah.
I was patient zero.
Oh, so, well, congratulations.
Yeah, it was was great, man. It was great. It was awesome. Like we did a COVID test on the way out of work one day out there in Simla, and man, it couldn't have been a worse situation, because I got back to the hotel when I got the results, and they were like, hey, we need you to come back into the facility. And I was like, why? And they're like, well, the facility is 100% infected, and you are infected, so we need to keep you here. And I was like, okay. And when I arrived, there was just news trucks everywhere.
Yeah.
I was just like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, don't talk to anybody. Just walk in the door. You're just going to keep working. I was like, what? Like, I got sick and you decided I was on 24/7 duty? That's how this is going to work? What happened to confined to quarters, bro? this was stupid. Yeah, the whole thing ended up being a shit show. Like, we ended up taking over at a long-term memory care facility. So we did, like, this three-day training with a bunch of doctors on, like, dementia and Alzheimer's and stuff. And then they just kind of, like, let us into this old people home. It was like, make sure nobody dies. And people died, like, every 5 minutes. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I mean.
Every couple minutes, another patient was passing away. And we were just like, I'm unequipped to handle this.
Yeah.
Particular situation.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's you know, the military's good with that, right? It's like, we're going to train you to be a warrior and a war fighter, but we're not going to train you on anything else, and we're going to expect you to do it when we ask you to. So, you know.
Exactly. And, it wasn't even, it's not like it was a hard, not by any means, you know, like, just kind of watching these guys, feeding them food, bringing their medicine and all that stuff. Y'all got QMAP trained. You know, but at the end of the day, like, they train us to lose people in times of war. They don't train us to lose people because they're coughing.
Yeah.
Or they just start, like, coughing out blood and stuff. Like, and actually, they train us to be very, 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 very scared of those particular side effects, actually.
Yeah.
You know, they take us through CERN, and they're like, hey, man, if you see this, run. Run fast. Run far. Run very far. Like,
yep.
Keep running. Don't stop running. Put everything on. Gas mask, suits, boots, gloves, man. Like, put it all on. Everything.
Yep.
And so, like, we're sitting here, we're watching this, and, like, this is all SOP guys, right? So it's all Rangers, TAPs, PJs. Like, the whole COVID mission was either medical or SOP. And so we're like, we shouldn't be here. I think we should our losses and everybody just leaves.
Yeah.
They're like, we can't do that, man. We gotta stick around. I'm like, dude, Ray's gonna die any minute now. Like, Ray's not gonna make it. I know Ray's not gonna make it. Ray had pneumonia when we got here. And you know, you throw in COVID on top of pneumonia, he's probably gonna die.
Yeah.
He's 94. Like, he's just not gonna make it.
Yeah.
And, Ray was the only one who did make it, which is crazy. He assaulted a few other residents, but, you know, creepy old man is what it is.
Yeah.
Back to that mission, man, and, like, I was lost in the sauce. The craziest part about my time in the Guard was the day I got there, I got asked if I would be the full-time NCO. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to. Love to. That would solve my part-time money problem. I will absolutely come be cool. On the way to work, I'm driving at like 3 a.m. on my way up to Denver, Colorado, and this truck next to me smashes into a deer and launches it right into the side of my car.
Mm.
Totaled my car, messed me up really bad, smashed my head through the window, broke my back, just horrible, right? So I call in, I spend 8 months in recovery on convalescent leave, and when I got back, they just, like, threw me out. Like, it was crazy. Any deployment they ever had, it was Smitty's job, right? Smitty will do it. Guaranteed. If you have a deployment, odds are he's going to raise his hand, right? But at the same time, anytime we were back on station and, you know, there was nothing going on, I was on shit detail from then on. You know, went from firewall 5 career to, you know, Hell, I don't think I even got an EPR the entire time I was in the garden. I was in there for 6 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was crazy. And to be fair, I was always gone. Like, always gone. I was always deployed at least 6 months out of the year, if not longer, for any given natural disaster that happened. But, like, that's where my career went to die. And, like, I firmly believe that. Like, people talk about a lot of really bad leadership in, especially in, like, the guard units and reserve units and stuff like that. And, like, I can say with whole certainty, absolutely that is happening.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very political system in the guard, right? Like, you're no longer promoted off merit. You're promoted off of whether a job is available and whether or not they like you.
Yeah.
Everything's a board. Everything is a board. And they will not hesitate to use any power in their power to get the things that they want out of it. And so when I got out, I had this really bitter taste in my mouth, military as a whole. I mean, the whole time I was in the guard, I was trying to get back to active duty, and they just wouldn't let me go back. And I was a pilot's chase, so like I was supposed to go back. Like, the whole point behind leaving my contract early by 2 years was that I would finish school, mission, go to flight school, come back to active duty as an officer. The idea was to be a pilot. And they stonewalled me every single step of that way. So never got my commission, even though all my paperwork says I'm a first lieutenant. Never ended up getting back to active duty. I ended up getting med boarded instead. And started suffering from all, pretty much every mental health issue you could possibly suffer from. Crazy amounts of depression, extreme amounts of anxiety. I was on edge all the time. I was hiding from work. Everybody hides from work, but especially if they're in E4. But it got to the point where I was, you know, I'd go wash trucks all day and just be gone all day and then come back, collect all my stuff and bounce.
Yeah.
That was every day. I couldn't even live in the same city as my unit. Like, I just couldn't do it. I moved out of state and travel back and forth to drill because I couldn't stand being around them and felt like all of them were out to get me all the time. And like, that's a horrible feeling for people that you're supposed to put the trust of your life into.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what they showed me. You know, I flew into drill one day when I was in college in Las Vegas, and you know, I told my first sergeant that, you know, I had to change my flight at the last minute. So instead of flying in the night before, I flew in the morning of, just due to weather concerns. They were canceling the flight, offered a later flight. So I was like, all right, cool, whatever. As long as I get there before duty, I don't really care.
Yeah.
Problem was, you know, DIA doesn't have rental cars open at 5 a.m. Opens at 7. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, all right, I got to get to work by like 6:30.
Yeah.
So calling everybody in my unit. Everybody was like, no, dude, I can't pick you up. Can't pick you up. Can't pick you up. Can't pick you up. Call first sergeant. He was like, we'll make sure somebody picks you up. I land. I walk outside. Nobody's there. No commander. No officers. No first sergeant. No NCOIC. Nobody. Nobody showed up. So I walked from DIA to Buckley. It took me 2.5 hours. By the time I got there, it's like 9 a.m. I'm walking in. I got a big duffel bag on my arm. I'm sweating like crazy. My uniform is just destroyed. And I get in, and they're like, Smitty, go clean up. Meet me in my office. So I go clean up, change into a new uniform. I was expecting to go straight to work, so I had already been dressed.
Yeah.
I get in there, and they wrote me an LOR for being late. And I was like, that's crazy. That's crazy. I called all of you at 5 a.m. That's crazy. I was 20 minutes up the road. 20 minutes up the road by car. You could have sent somebody. You could have asked for my location. You could have done anything. But you literally let me down. And you literally just left me there. And then blamed me for you leaving there. It was horrible. And, like, it was at that point where I was like, you know what? I'm over this. I'm gonna go see my health. because like I'm about 3 seconds away from raging out in this building right now. And they're like, you should do that. And I was like, fine, I'll do that. I'm gonna go talk to the chaplain, and then I'm gonna go to mental health. I was like, I'm gonna go calm my ass down, and I did. I went straight to our chapel and spoke with the pastor for probably 45 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
Left his office, went straight to Miss Virginia's office, the behavioral health director. And I sat in there and she was like, hey, I'm going to do a DSM-5 on you. And I was like, okay, what good is that going to do? And I had to go to mental health that day anyway. We had just gotten off deployment, so I had to do my post-deployment screening. And I was like, okay, I'll just get it done. I'm just using this as a therapy session, talk about all the things that are pissing me off. And I get in there and she's like, hey, I think we need to look at your DSM-5. So they go through, actually, like, this is concerning. I'm going to recommend you for an MRI. I was like, that's weird. So I go in and I do this MRI, and they found out that my adrenal gland was the size of a mandarin orange. She was like, you've been in fight or flight for a long time, haven't you? I was like, well, I stay deployed.
Yeah.
Like I never come home. She was like, hey, you're not supposed to do that. I was like, well, why? And she was like, well, it's not good for you. Like, adrenaline is great in spurts.
Yeah.
It's great for the little things that you need it for. But it's toxic to the body long term. And it's having a clear and apparent effect on your overall physical health. And I was like, oh, okay. Is it bad? She was like, it's bad enough that I'm recommending your immediate discharge. And I was like, what's that mean? She was like, it means today is your last day ever. I was like, oh.
Wow.
Oh. I was like, this is not at all how I thought this conversation was going to go. So now what? She was like, now you have a choice. She's like, your contract is up in 9 months. You either get out today or you can fight my decision. Problem with that is it's going to take you 12 months to go through this med board. So while you're spending 12 months trying to convince the Air Force that you should stay in, your contract's going to lapse and you won't be in anyway. Because the colonel is not going to renew your contract. He doesn't like you. You don't like him, so I guess that doesn't surprise anyone. He's like, but even if he did like you, he can't in good conscience approve you to stay. Like, it's time. Like, it's time to hang it up.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm not ready. You know? Like, I don't have anything set up. I don't Hell, I've been in college this whole time. I don't know what to do with myself, with my life. I don't know anything. I don't even know how to be a civilian yet. Never been home enough to finish a lease, let alone, understood how to do credit or get a job or, do anything. She was like, that's, unfortunately, that's something you're going to have to live with. And I was like, okay. Just give me the paperwork. I'll go get everything filled out. So I got everything done. I took one last selfie and was like, it's time. This is over. This is my entire life is now whatever comes after this. So I took it and I went back to California with my wife and I was like, I'm lost. I don't know what to do. And I slipped into depression really, really bad, like really bad.
Yeah.
And it got to a point where I literally cut everybody off. I split up from my wife for a couple days, started sleeping in my car. I hid out for like 3 days. She finally got a hold of me and I was like, oh yeah, I'm not going to go to Disney World with you guys. They all flew to Disney World. And as soon as they took off, I went to an empty parking lot and I put a gun in my head. And it was that fast. So within 60 days of discharge, and when nothing happened, gun didn't go off. I was pissed. I was very upset about that fact. Like, I looked at it and I was like, you motherfucker. I was like, I'm supposed to trust you with my life and I can't even trust you to end it.
Yeah.
And so like, I went to go rack another ring. So I was like, oh, you know what? It's very old ammunition. I've had this gun 10 years, never had to use it, So like these rounds have been in this magazine for 10 years now. Maybe that's why. You know, maybe I just had a light powder strike, and you know, I just didn't go off. Whatever, I'll go to the next round. Wrapped it, cop pulled up as I was putting it back to my head. I threw the gun like a bag of weed. And he comes up and he was like, "Hey, are you you Clayton?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm going to jail." I was like, "I don't even know what I did, but I'm going to jail. I got a gun in my car. I'm going to jail. Definitely going to jail." He was like, "Your fiance sent me. She was worried about you, and she found your location on your phone." And I was like, "Oh, thank God. Thank God." He's like, "You doing okay?" I was like, "No. No, I'm not." He's like, "You want to step out of the car for me?" I stepped out of the car, and my hands are trembling. And he's like, "You don't look good, man." I was like, "Well, I haven't eaten in 4 days." And he just came up and he gave me a hug, and he was like, "You're a veteran, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, recent." And he's like, "Me too, man. I know what it's like to struggle like that." He's like, "You don't got a gun on you or anything, do you? No way of hurting me." I was like, "I do, man. It's on the floorboard in your passenger seat." And he was like, "Okay, go ahead and have a seat over here. We're gonna take care of you." Like, 8 more cop cars showed up.
Yeah.
I was like, "Take care of me. So you're gonna take me to jail." Got it. they came up and they were like, "Hey, we gotta handcuff you for your safety and ours." And I was like, "Okay, no worries." And they were like, "Do you want to go to the VA?" I was like, I would love that. So brought me down to the VA. Next thing I know, I was put on a good old 5150. 72-hour hold, which turned into a 6-day hold, which pissed me off because every time I thought I was going to leave that place, I didn't. And let me tell you, mental health facilities are far more terrifying than anywhere else I've ever been in my life. And I've been in war a lot. But crazy people who can't be predicted, are the scariest thing I've ever put up with.
Yeah.
I'm trying to sleep next to a schizo who's bashing his head to a wall the whole night. Real hard. Real hard. So I was miserable. I was very upset about that. But when I got out of there, I was like, you know what? That's never happening again. I will never go back to one of those. Ever. I was like, I'll go to jail. I'll go to prison before I ever go to one of those again. And so fast forward, I go to find a deal with the VA. Dealt with the VA, and it went about as expected. They gave me 70% right on the spot. I was like, "Oh, that's cool, I guess." And then it got worse. I was like, "Okay, you can go back." So I went back, and they're like, "Yeah, no, you're 100% disabled." And I was like, "Okay, cool. So now what?" And they're like, "Try not to be stupid." And I was like, "Okay, I'll try that." And they recommended adrenaline therapy to me one time. And I wound up going and doing some skydiving, which I had obviously gone to jump school. So I hated the idea that I would ever pay somebody to do something that I got paid to do.
Yeah. That makes sense.
you know, but I did it because my brother wanted to go. My brother was super interested in it. He was like, "Man, I want to try skydiving." And I was like, "Yeah, sure you do." I was like, "You say that till you're in a tree, you're stuck there till somebody comes and finds you."
I've never said that, just for the record. I don't ever want to go skydiving. When I was in AIT, everybody's like, "Oh, you should go airborne. You know, you get better duty stations, better pay." I was like, "Yeah, but I don't like going up in an airplane or coming down in an airplane."
And not coming down in it.
I'm not jumping out of one. There's no way. I'm not doing it.
Oh man, see, I'm the opposite, man. I loved it. I had moments where I was backflipping out of the back of the plane.
Bro,
I called it the praise Jesus, right? So, like, I got up to the back, I turned around, I looked at our rookie, and I was like, "Peace out, Cub Scout. Lord help me." And just fell backwards. And he was like, "What? Did he just..."
Look, my wife, right before I joined the Army, she talked me into going parasailing in Myrtle Beach, right? So
that's bad. That's out.
Yeah. Well, so the thing about it is she talked me into it, like, kinda. And I was like, I guess I'll do it. But there was a storm coming in. So the guy was like, if you guys are going to go, you got to go now. Like, this is, you'll be our last ride out. So, of course, you know, my wife wanted to do it. I did not. I'm going to stand my ground on that one. I did not want to do it, but I was going to do it with her, right? So we went out there, yeah. And they hook us up, and we start going. And the guy's like, all right, time for a picture. And my wife looks over at me, and she's like, no, you got to, like, you got to get that face off, because you got to smile or something for this picture. I was terrified, man. Absolutely terrified. Yeah. They were asking us if they wanted us to, you know, if they wanted us to dip in the water. Keep me up for a short amount of time and then bring me back down to the damn boat. That's what I want you to do. It was awful. Awful.
The crazy thing about it is, like, that's how I am with roller coasters. I hate roller coasters. I hate them.
I love roller coasters.
I've seen Final Destination like too many times. I don't like the thought that I'm not in control.
Yeah.
Right? That's really what it comes down to, is like, I'm not in control of where this is going. Even if I can see the tracks, like, I don't know where this is going. Right? And the fact that I do know where it's going when I do is worse. So, you know, and you can argue that, like, you know, with skydiving and stuff, like, the same kind of concept, man.
Yeah.
But, like, you do have some semblance of control, right? And when it comes time to hit the brakes and make your landing, you know, the ones of us that are pretty good at it, right? We can really control that landing, right?
Yeah.
Just that last little second of lift to make a nice little graceful touch rather than a, you know, patty cake with the earth. Which, by the way, you lose.
Yeah.
Trust me. I've played that game a long time. but, like, it's crazy, man. I learned pretty early on, because I mean I raced cars for a living as a kid. You know, I started off in karts when I was like 5 or 6. I started riding dirt bikes and stuff, and you know, got up to driving Ginetta Juniors, and then, you know, making it up to driving for Porsche for a little bit, and then, you know, that's what spurred me into the Air Force, was because I chose to go to college instead of continue competing in motorsports, and I couldn't afford college either. So,
yeah,
you know, I had to make a change. But with going fast and doing stupid stuff, it forces you to shut everything off. And being on a roller coaster or paragliding or any of those things where you're not truly in control, you can't do that.
Yeah,
right? Your brain doesn't laser focus. And so, like, that to me is the big difference, right? When I'm in a rally car going 120 down a, you know, dirt road in the middle of the forest, the only thing on my mind is left foot, right hand, left hand. That's it. Right? When I'm in a race car going around a circuit in Laguna Seca, you know, like, it's left foot, right arm, left arm. Where's the apex? Where's the window? Right? The only thing on my mind is what's immediately in front of me. Rent doesn't matter. The kids matter, obviously, but, like, what they're getting into doesn't matter right now.
Yeah.
My wife's opinion on the latest Bachelor episode doesn't matter. You know, and it's just you and whatever you're doing. And skydiving is the same way. And there's a pretty popular video of Will Smith going skydiving with Rachel Ray. And he talked about how the most liberating and free things in his life are on the other side of fear.
Yeah.
Right? The things that scare us the most are the things that will liberate us the most. And I firmly agree with that. You know, like, it's hard, because that's a symptom, by the way, on DSM-5. Is the feeling of saying, hey, I'm scared of this, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, that recklessness is considered a symptom. But at the same time, you have to do it. We're adrenaline junkies. And it's really what it comes down to, is we're adrenaline junkies. My life has been monumentally better since the day I decided to pursue adrenaline as fuel rather than trying to figure out why I couldn't be like everyone else.
Yeah.
Because that's what led me to not fit in. and, you know, struggle with depression and all the anxiety and stuff was because I'm used to being under threat all my life, even before the military, right? Like, even in school as a kid and in life as a kid. Like, we grew up dirt poor, right? Like, literally didn't have a pot to piss in for. So, you know, when my dad would bring home a go-kart that was probably stolen, you know, that was life-changing for me, but, like, we could hardly eat.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, for me, looking out, I think the hardest part for me was losing that financial stability that I had come to rely on, because I was like, I'll never be poor again. I'm never going to be the way I grow. My kids will never see that. And, you know, that threat was there, and I was like, damn, I did exactly what I said I would never do.
Yeah.
Ever hear that. Because I made bad decisions, or I did this, or I did that. And, you know, I thank God every day for my life. That's why, like, I can't let the woman go. you know, I'm like you're far too important to me. You know, she saved my life more times than I can count. And so now, you know, obviously we have the nonprofit. You know, so we have Red Tails. And, you know, the whole point behind that is, you know, showing people that veterans can compete at the highest level. You know, showing people that, like, these guys, their capabilities don't end when the service ends. Right? We're not broken. We're not used goods. We're not discarded. We're not, you know, bums on the side of the street begging for spare change. Like, we're adrenaline addicted, caffeine addicted, definitely caffeine addicted. You know, athletes that were forced to do the hardest job on the planet for years. And, you know, to commit the cardinal sin, right? Like the sin of sins, right?
Yep.
We were trained to fight and kill in the name of people that we don't know. And, you know, you put those guys in a race car, or you put them on a pit crew, and once they're all in on it, it's amazing how much better they do than an actual pit crew.
Yeah, I mean, you take
the speed, the precision, the discipline.
You take that adrenaline and you focus it into something else. And I mean, it's just a hyper focus from a lot of vets. I mean, that's you're 100% right. I mean, it's insane to think about. Like, that's not even a skill that you pick up in the military. But once, like you said, once they're bought in and they figure it out, it's like that's what they were meant to do. You know, because they put a hyper focus into it, especially if they enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an opportunity for us to live the same culture and lifestyle that we had in the military, right? And that, to me, is the biggest thing, right? Like, we're doing a barbecue today for our board secretary's birthday. And, you know, like, we're wrenching on the race car and drinking a couple beers and stuff, and barbecuing and all that. And it's like, I remember being at my duty station, man, and, like, literally, if we get off work, we'd have a beer. Like, right there, at squadron, like, we'd have a beer right there. Yeah. And then, you know, everybody go home, and we'd drink and cook out and party and dance and have a fucking good time, and the sirens would go off, right? Sirens would go off, and it's back to business. Drunk or not, hungry or not, like, burger still on the grill, turning into a charcoal brick or not.
Yep.
Right? When the siren goes off, you pick up your weapon, and you go fight. And, you know, that ability to just snap in, right, is uncommon in the civilian workforce. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
No one else has it. That ability to go from a dead sleep straight into not just warfare, right? Because there's a lot of people that go and fight, right? Like, people fight for stuff all the time. You know, looking at the news right now, seeing China being a paper dragon and Moscow being made of porcelain. It's amazing to me, because I'm like, man, we should have fought a long time ago.
Yeah.
A long time. We should have just gotten this over with. Because, like, this would have been a cakewalk. Because the Ukrainians don't know how to fight. India does not know how to fight. And they are all Indian. Both of them are. And so, like, I just look at it, And I'm like, that is a skill set of the U.S. military that cannot be matched. The ability to not just engage in warfare, but engage in warfare with a will to fight that is unseen anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Nobody attacks with the level of aggression and precision that the U.S. military does.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. It's amazing to watch. And, like, I see all the videos of these young troops with their hat turned all sideways like this, toothbrushes in their mouth and stuff. And on the one hand, I'm embarrassed. But on the other hand, I'm like, the craziest thing is they can be as stupid as you think they are. But the second that order is given, those kids will kill without thought, without malice, without hesitation, because the military-industrial complex has gotten so damn good at laser-focusing a bunch of ADHD-riddled, like, athletes, basically, right?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody played something. You know, like, usually football players. I feel like a lot of football players end up in the military. I feel like that number's pretty high. Football and basketball.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, you take that aggression that was honed in on a playbook and on a quarterback, and you put that into a guy and say, hey, man, I need you to pin down that element right there. Like, don't let them move. Just continuous fire on that spot right there. You guys are going to go that way, right? And you see that. And you start to realize it's not the troops that matter, it's the leaders that matter. Right? As long as we still have very damn good officers, the rest will follow. Because you learn everything.
Yep. Right?
I mean, Fat Electrician had a joke that, you know, the American officer serves as like Uncle Sam's condom. You know, a pressure regulator, if you will. And I agree with that. But only once the troops have learned from him, they've learned the tactics, they've learned where he wants them to be, when he wants them to be there, and all that stuff, and you have NCOs that are equally as adept. At that point, when you lose an officer, probably for the worst, for the enemy, because they know where they're going, they know what they're doing, they know the battle plan, they know that they're going to execute, they're going to take care of it. And that same... I don't even know what to call it, right? Because it's not grit, it's not discipline, it's not skill or, you know, sharpness. It's all of those things, right? Those skill sets, when honed in on something fun, right? That's compassion. Don't give us a competition. Definitely don't give us a competition where the rules are break rules.
Yeah.
Like if the rule is find a loophole,
done.
You allow the wrong people into your sport because we will find all of them.
All of
the loopholes will be found. I mean, hell, it's easy. It's very easy to find loopholes. If you didn't write a rule, I promise you, I'm going to make you write one. And, you know, it's been amazing. And, you know, it's extended into us just being able to go and hang out and wrench with vets around the community. And that's been awesome, too. I mean, we have guys that call us every day, like, hey, I'm working on my car this week. And I'm just, like, really not feeling well. You know, is there any chance, you know, you guys can come down, hang out for a little bit, just talk to me while I work on the car or something? You know, and if you're down to help, like, I'd absolutely accept it. And we're like, yeah, dude, you know what? If nothing else, I will, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm retired. I have nothing better to do other than run the nonprofit. So, like, if it comes down to, like, there's a vet that wants someone to hang out with for whatever reason, I will go there myself. You know, I'm never going to send, like, a random person in my stead, right? Like, obviously, why I just went in my face twice. That's why I don't do stuff in the garage, man. But, like, I was just at a vet's house just a couple days ago, and he was like, look, man, since we moved here, you know, I've got nobody. And like, I fell into alcohol when we first moved here really bad. And I've been sober for 2 years and, you know, still kind of lonely. but I'm not relying on alcohol anymore. And I was like, well, you know what, man? Anytime you want to work on the car, you call me.
Yeah.
Anytime you want to hang out, you call me. Here's my number. Call me. Like, if you hear about somebody that needs something, call me. We were just helping out with another nonprofit out here furnishing houses for veterans. So they work with the HUD, and when a veteran gets into one of the housing department houses, these guys go and furnish it for them for free. Right? Give them a bed, give them a TV, a dresser, you know, all the things they would need, a couch. Because they decided that, you know, four walls doesn't make a home. And yeah, people with mental health disorders, you know, being in four walls, life moves slower inside than it does outside. So they're going to spend most of their time outside. And unfortunately, getting into drugs and all the other bad stuff. So they were like, you know, we're gonna furnish the place and hopefully make them feel at home because they want to be there and, you know, keep them out of trouble. And they've done a little over 800 homes in the last 5 years. And, you know, at this point, they've seen a drastic reduction in evictions, a drastic reduction in the number of drug-related incidents. Like, it's down, you know, to single digits now. And it's like, hell yeah, dude. Like, hell yeah. I'll come help you furnish some dude's house any day of the week. Call me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome,
so,
man.
They actually just... Dude, they were so great. And they were like, do you guys need anything for the race car or anything? You know, would you guys be willing to build a couple cars that we find in, like, barns and stuff? They're like, dude, if you find anything car-related, call me. Like, we'll build it and auction it off and you know, refund that money back towards vets. You know, like, for us, it's more about having work to do than it is about having, you know, the race team out on the track, right?
Like, yeah.
Having this broken is more of an opportunity than having it running.
Yeah.
Because when it's broken, I can invite a vet down to come and, you know, spend time in my garage with me, have a beer, talk about what they're going through, and, you know, cut some wires or something.
Yeah.
Right? And every little act of kindness like that keeps one more person from thinking about their head. And that's all we care about. That's all we want.
Yeah, right? Absolutely, man.
Everybody to just avoid being stupid like me. Because it only happened once, but it was enough to change my life.
Yeah, and, you know,
It wasn't for the better at the moment, but it is for the better now.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one thing a lot of people don't think of. Just because it's life-changing immediately doesn't mean that it's for the better immediately. You know, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. I mean, I've been working at this thing for... I like to joke and say that it took me 36 years to realize I had a problem, and it's taken me 2 years to get to where I am right now. So, you know, I've been working at this thing for what feels like forever, and I still have days. I mean, even doing the podcast, man, this podcast really helps me out because I found what helped me was to share my story. So I just recorded it. Like, you know, at a high level, recorded, didn't go into detail, but I recorded a lot of my story, and I was like, all right, here, click every podcast platform I can think of. That's where it's going. So every time somebody hits play, I'm telling my story. Somebody's hearing my story, and I have that in my mind, and it helps. And, but, you know, to your point, still to this day, man, I still have days. You know, the other day, I kind of had a moment. I was inside my head, kind of snapped at my wife. She was like, hey, yo, you know, like, hey, what is that? And I was like, that was, hold on. Let me take a minute. Right. You know, I've done the therapy, the podcast selfishly is therapy also for other people that want to get on here and share their story, therapy for them. But you know, I'm on the medication. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. But you're still going to have those bad days, man. It's not a war that you win. It's a battle that you fight. And every day you gain ground. You'll never get to the end, but you'll gain ground on it. Right. And I think the stuff that you're talking about doing, the stuff that you guys do, is just absolutely so important, because it just it gives guys like, I mean, even think about guys like me, right? I had three kids, I had my wife, and I still went down this dark road, right? It's not,
yeah.
People like to say, well, you have a good job, you make good money, you have a wife, you have kids, like, what more could you want? Well, I don't want anymore.
Why are you depressed?
Yeah, I don't want anymore, yeah. Right? I have what I want. I have what I need. That's not why I'm feeling this way. I don't feel this way because, you know, I feel like my kids don't love me or something. No, I know they love me. I know they look up to me. I know that they want me to be here for them, right? And I want to be here for them. It has nothing to do with that. It's being trapped in your own head and not being able to get out. And it's a hard thing that we all live with.
If you don't mind, I'm actually going to show you something real quick.
Yeah.
So on the side of the race car, we got these little demons right here, right?
Yeah.
And each one of those is a symptom of PTSD. So, you know, you have depression, you have mania, you have rage, you have amnesia, right?
Yep.
Or no, that's confusion, amnesia. Manic rage, intense rage, and death down at the bottom.
Yep.
And the reason why we put those on the car, right, and actually on the car, inside of all this right here, those are all 22s. The 22 a day. So every square inch of that black is covered in tiny little 22s all over the place. So, like, all of that was put on there not to make the car look good. Because it doesn't. It honestly pisses people off when we go to any event. Like, oh, you guys graffiti bombed your car. Yeah, you're right. You're right. This was also a totaled car, which is exactly what a veteran's like, right? When we got this car, the front end wasn't even connected to it.
Yeah.
It was torn off. You know, the back end had a huge dent in it, and, you know, we repaired all that. We put, you know, $20,000 worth of suspension into it. We repainted it. We got rid of all the rust. And then you look at it and you're like, man, this is exactly like what happens to vets. But if you look at the amount of money the VA spends to do our healthcare, even on the crappy level that, you know, we believe that they do it on, it's a ton of money.
Yeah.
Ton of money, right? Like, a prosthetic limb, right? Because my stepdad was a Marine and lost his leg. And his prosthetic limb costs around $800,000. And he has to have it remade every 4 months. So that is, you know, a little over $2 million every year.
Yeah.
That the VA spends on him for the last 20 years. That's a lot of money.
That's crazy.
Do it in-house, right? And so, like, for us, we were like, well, you know, we could scrap this car. We could go get something that runs it, already log booked, already had it caged, already ready to go, already been racing, you know? And it's like, well, what does that do? To me, like, if I can liken the cars to the same people that I'm helping, right? That's like finding a kid out of high school and having him join the military. That's what that is.
Yep.
Or finding somebody who's already in right now, who hasn't hit their struggles yet. Like, that's not what we want to show the from the ashes. Right? We want to show that the rebirth, that even though this car says total loss on the title, it's a race-winning car. It's a car that isn't meant to make you look at it and go, wow, that's a beautiful car. It's a freaking Infiniti, man. Like, never do that. No matter how nice we make it, it would never make you stop and go, wow, it's a very nice car. Like, you would just be like, oh, okay, that's a cool little G35, I guess. You know? So knowing that, it's not super car. It's not perfect. Nice. So we're like, all right, what can we do? We can force people to look at it. We can make you stare at it. We can make it so outlandish, so absolutely stupid, that you have no choice but to stop it. Right? On the side right there, it's ask, listen, be like, I rise, I fight, I prevail. Ghosts inside never sleep, even when I do, right? all of those words are words for veterans that need help, right? So literally all over the card. So, like, we're the ones the demons want, right? We remember and we fight to honor the fallen, but we fight for the living, right? Scars tell stories. I am still here. That's on the hood of the car. That's the first thing you see when the car pulls up at the back. Very first thing you see. Right? On the side of the car, when we have a passenger ride for the first time, right? It literally says, would you notice if I was struggling? Right there on the top of the car. So when they open the door to get in, that's what they have to read. Right? And so for us, we were like, listen, I don't care if you think what we did to the car looks stupid. I don't care if you think it looks great. That's not what I care about. What I care about is when you see it, does it make you want to call your brother in Okinawa? Does it make you want to call your sister in Germany? Does it make you want to call your cousin in Georgia? And be like, hey, buddy, how you doing? Doing okay? Haven't heard from you in a while. You know, like the second we got this done and clear-coded, the first thing all of us did was we all called at least one buddy of ours from active duty.
Yeah.
Every single one of them. We were like, hey, man, how you doing? Is everything okay? You know, and I was like, that is the exact thing that we wanted with it. We took it to a Cars and Coffee before I broke it. And most of the people that were there, obviously being purists with their restored classic cars and their Ferraris and their 80s Mercedes and stuff,
yeah,
hated it. But this young couple, his brother is currently serving as a Marine. And he's overseas right now. And, you know, the wife, her dad had served in Vietnam. And she was like, can we take a picture with your car? And I was like, yeah. And as soon as they took the picture, he was like, I'm going to call my brother as soon as we leave here. And I was like, well, man, that's the point. That's all I want out of this, is for you guys to see this and go, damn, I need to make a phone call.
Yeah.
I need to make sure that everybody's okay. I just want to ask and be there. And I'm just like, cool. We win. That's all it's about. None of the rest of this stuff matters. Like, we never compete in a single race. As long as somebody stopped, then they saved at least one life. And that makes the car worth it, even if it's a hunk of junk.
Yeah. Man, that's awesome. That's awesome. I love it. I don't know, man. Just looking at the car and everything you just showed me, like, I absolutely love it. Like, I can't even put into words how much I love it. But, you know, I really appreciate everything that you're doing. I appreciate you sharing your story. Really appreciate you coming on the show. I think that, you know, this has been phenomenal, and it's, you know, every story that I think is shared on the show is kind of like a breath of fresh air, right? Because every time I talk to somebody, I hear a different way that somebody's struggling, or I hear a different way that somebody's been able to recover, right? And it's pretty awesome. Because, you know, you always hear, well, there's different ways to get over everything, right? There's 10 million different ways to get over stuff. But you don't ever think about it, because you think about the way you got over something. And you're like, well, that doesn't work because I tried it and it didn't work. No, it works for somebody else, right? And, you know, that's another really important thing about this, is people have to know that you're going to try, just like I did, and just like I'm sure you did, you're going to try 100 different things. You're going to find one or two that work. But it's not going to be the first thing that you find that works. It's going to be that 100th thing, right? Because then once you find that thing that works, you're going to want to keep doing it.
Exactly. Like, I call it accuracy by volume. You know, I'm going to keep spitting rounds down range. One of them is going to hit the target.
Yep. Exactly.
You know, I'll try anything at least once. You know, and one day you're going to find the thing that really helps you. And when you do, odds are it'll help others too.
Yep.
And in my mind, right, like, we owe it to everybody else to at least let them try. And if it doesn't help them, it doesn't help them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? But, like, people will find you.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think the biggest thing for me is, because I've been there and because I know what it takes, you know, your mental health is your responsibility, right? But we, just like you said, man, we owe it to others like us to share our experiences, because I know for a fact, after I tried a couple of things and they didn't work, I was done. I didn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
Had it not been for my wife, yeah, I wouldn't have made it to where I am today. And I, you know, I recognize that. I put in the work. I did a lot to improve myself. But the first couple of times I put in that work, it was really hard. It was really difficult. And it didn't work.
Well, and when you fall, sometimes you need somebody to hold a hand out for you.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
To help you stand back up again. To tell you that it's okay that you fell down. You know, and that you have to get back up again.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, I feel the same way about my wife, right? Like, when I left, you know, she was devastated. She was like, you know, why were you leaving? Why are you doing all this? And I was like, look, I was trying to die.
Yeah.
Like, and I knew the day I left that I was trying to die. So it was either like, okay, I'll either starve myself or I'll shoot myself.
Yeah.
And, like, it depends on which one is more comfortable. And so, like, when I left, like, I knew what I was doing. She didn't.
Yeah.
I did. And thankfully, she noticed the signs and was like, "All right, I'm gonna do a welfare check. I'm gonna send the police everywhere that he might go. And if I can get his location, I'll send them there." And that's what she did, and it saved my life. And she's constantly been the thing that reminds me of where my mental health is.
Yeah.
If I start stepping out with that rage, right? Like, she'll be the first person to check me.
Yep.
You know, if, like. Because now, as a stay-at-home dad, right, like, it's my responsibility to, you know, teach my three sons how to manage their anger. And it's like, I tell them all the time, I'm like, listen, dad doesn't always do the anger thing well. Sometimes, yep, I get mad, sometimes I yell. You know, sometimes I look scary, but at the end of the day, I'm never going to stop loving them. And, like, I'm always going to apologize if my feelings get too much, right? Yep. And that's something that I've had to learn is, like, okay, if you see that you're getting frustrated over literally spilled milk, stop, apologize. Don't be your kid's first bully. Don't be the reason why your kid isn't there 20 years later talking about unresolved childhood trauma.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that statement just resonates in my mind all the time. And I'm like, I thank God for my wife. Because if it wasn't for her patience, I would not be here.
Yeah.
I probably would have pissed somebody off and then shot me. I know that for a fact. So, you know, between her and adrenaline, like, life has been much better.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I can give any message to anybody out there, it's just try it.
Yeah.
Try it. Don't do anything that's going to, like, put your life at risk, because that's stupid. That's a bad idea. But,
yeah.
You know, go. The reason why there's all those marathons for veterans is because it's adrenaline. It's adrenaline therapy, right? Like, it's oxytocin and adrenaline. And when you're out there and you're running it, feel great. Like, run a mile every day. Just do it.
You'll
thank you later. You know, if you get an opportunity to go out on a racetrack, do it. If you can't do that, go ride some go-karts. Go have fun. Go ride the jet ski. Go take the boat out. Do fun stuff. Be a kid again. Like, because they robbed you of that. They took your 20s away.
Yeah.
Enjoy a little bit of it.
All right, man. Well.
That's my message for everybody, man.
Hey, I appreciate it. And that message, I'm sure, resonates with a lot of people. Especially me. I mean, you know, I didn't join early on. I joined later. I joined when I was 27. So, you know, I had a lot of life experience. before that. But, you know, a lot of the trauma that I experienced came from my childhood. It wasn't in the military. It wasn't in my adult life, right? So,
yeah.
You know, I didn't have a childhood. I didn't have the opportunity to be a teenager, you know, like most people get to. It was something that I never really experienced. I started experiencing a little bit later in life. And, you know, when I turned 18, I was going to join the Army, and I was like, you know what, I'll probably get kicked out because I want to go do some stupid shit, right? So I didn't join when I was 18.
Yep.
Joined when I was 27. It all happens differently for us, but we all got to find the same path, which is a different path, right? It just all leads down the same road, right? Again, I appreciate you coming on the show, man. I'm really looking forward to this release. Thank you for everything. I really love the car. Really love what you guys are doing. I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, man.